From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm may seem like quaint remnants of the past, but have you been to the movies lately? This is Hollywood's latest spin on the Hansel and Gretel story. They're not urchins in lederhosen, they're ass-kickers in form-fitting leather and straps. The scholar Maria Tatar says we're always reinventing these fairy tales. It's almost like there's a cycle to it. The earliest versions were violent and earthy and could be downright naughty. The Grimm brothers cleaned them up and turned them into cautionary tales for children. But now they seem to be headed back into the themes of cruelty and sex. We're talking about the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm today. Maria Tatar is our guest. We'll talk about what these tales tell us about ourselves after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Well, it was bound to happen that over the years people would sand the rougher edges off the fairy tales of the past. The earliest versions of the stories weren't for kids, really. The scholar Maria Tatar says they were for the grown-ups. They were tales that were supposed to help shorten the time devoted to mending, sewing, spinning, stuff like that. And you needed something to break up the monotony. And maybe that's why they could be really violent, these stories, or sexual. Take a story like Little Red Riding Hood. Maria Tatar says, really, that's a tale about gluttony, sexuality, and mortality. You know, the basics, food, sex, death. The brothers Grimm, Jacob and Wilhelm, took the fables of an oral storytelling tradition and made them presentable for children, which really just meant taking out the sex. There's still plenty of violence in their fairy tales, cannibalism and mutilation, ogres, of course, nasty stepmothers. Today in the program, we're talking about the fairy tales of the brothers Grimm. Tatar says we're always reworking and retelling these stories. She says they offer roadmaps to romance and riches, and she says a way out of the woods, back to the safety and security of home. We invite you to join us today if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Maria Tatar is a professor of Germanic languages and literature at Harvard University, where she also chairs the Folklore and Mythology program. She's authored and edited many books, including the annotated Brothers Grimm, which was re-released last year to commemorate the bicentennial of the first edition of the Brothers Grimm collection of fairy tales. And Maria Tatar is joining us today from a studio on the campus of Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Maria Tatar, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
I was interested, first of all, in when it is you first became interested in stories like this. Were you interested in the language part, the story part? What first drew you to this?
I was first drawn into the world of fairy tales through the illustrations. I had a book. It was in the attic of our house, so it's just almost magical. My sister and I discovered the book, and it was called Die schönsten Kindermärchen der Brüder Grimm, the most beautiful fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. And she read the stories to me. She didn't know German. I didn't know German. But since she was a few years older, she was able to reinvent the stories based on her experience with narrative in grade school. And we both just doted on the illustrations, these beautiful images, not by a world-class artist, but, you know, we could look at Snow White, at not so much the fact that she was in a glass coffin, but that she was surrounded by these brilliant red roses and these curious dwarfs surrounding her and hoping that she will soon revive. So there was something magical to that.
So does that give you a sense of what the sort of more general appeal of these stories, you know, is for the rest of us? It's more than just that they have some kind of morality tale connected to it. It's that they're just good stories, I guess, in part.
Exactly. It's what you described at the beginning. That is, these tales make direct hits. They give us melodrama. Updike referred to them, John Updike referred to them as the television and pornography of an earlier age. And yes, you know, we took out some of the Grimms took out many of the off-color episodes. They no longer had a young man who could make women pregnant just by looking at them. That story was dropped out of the second edition. And so they're stories that we just can't let go of because they do take up these fundamental cultural questions. Little Red Riding Hood, innocence and seduction. As you mentioned, food, sex, and death. How do you survive? How do you navigate your way out of the woods? How do you get back home?
I wonder.
So it is. It's that beauty that I discovered as a child, and you know, the horror I think didn't really hit me until I started reading the stories to my children. And you know, we're protective in the 20th. We were in the 20th, and we are in the 21st century as well. So there were stories, and I suddenly saw in my mind's eye the scenes of decapitation that take place. And that's when I started worrying and wondering and questioning, you know, where did these stories come from? How did the Grimms get their hands on them? And what did they do with the tales? And how do we reinvent them today?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about let's talk about the Grimms themselves. I mean, they're born into a reasonably affluent family in the central part of Germany, but when they're fairly young, their father dies, and I guess in some ways, could it be said that they were left to kind of fend for themselves?
Oh, yes, for sure. That is, the safety and security of the home was shattered. And suddenly they were dependent on the kindness, not necessarily of strangers, but of patrons, of relatives. And they managed to make their way out into the world, get themselves an education, which was, you know, an impossible feat for a family that did not have means at all. And they ended up as diplomats, librarians. They held these posts as professors, and then as these great scholars and philologists who published not just fairy tales, but created a German dictionary, the first German dictionary. They only got up to the letter F, but they also wrote many put out many editions, edited editions of older works. They spent a lot of time in their study together, scribbling on note cards.
It's interesting. I read somewhere where they tended to work in the same room with their desks facing each other. So how do you describe their relationship? Pretty close, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. From the time that they were young and they experienced the loss of the father and they went to school together, they were they were separable, but for many years, I think they were almost inseparable, living in the same house, sleeping in the same bed. Those were times when, you know, a family couldn't necessarily afford more than one or two beds. But they were also social. That is, they had a wide circle of acquaintances. Wilhelm married, Jakob did not. It was from that circle of acquaintances that they drew these stories. They asked their friends, they asked colleagues who lived in other parts of Germany to send them stories that they had heard. So they didn't quite go out roaming in the countryside listening to the tales told by peasants around the fireside. But some of the stories from the fireside ended up in their collection because they were the tales that that their friends had heard from nannies or from servants and from tradesmen.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that is part of the myth. I mean, you get the sense that they're a little bit like Alan Lomax. That's the myth, right? Going out and talking to the peasants and the, you know, guys on the chain gang to tell them their stories. It's not quite that. But they did get the stories, I guess.
They got the stories. And, you know, I kind of believe that these stories belong to everyone.
Yeah.
And as long as you identify the source and then maybe even try to trace it to, when it comes to fairy tales, there is no original source. That's the great thing about them.
Yeah.
They just circulate as variants. So they were completely upfront about who told these stories, who their informants were. But they did at the same time believe that this was the poetry of the people,
right,
and the poetry of nature, the voice of nature that is somehow mediated through the folk, through this peasant culture. And it then migrates into all kinds of other places.
You know, at the very beginning of the program, we played an excerpt of the Hollywood movie Hansel and Gretel, just to give you a sense of how, you know, these stories are adapted. And of course, it's a story with lots of, you know, Hollywood graphics and explosions and all of those kinds of things, which raises the question of whether or not these kinds of stories are accomplishing the same kinds of purposes in the, you know, in the 21st century, in the 20th century. Do they still do the same things for us today?
I think that they don't accomplish the same purpose as, say, the story that is used in bedtime reading.
Yeah.
That, you know, adults have this great way of using bedtime reading as a kind of contact zone for the child. So Little Red Riding Hood may be a scary story, but if you're reading it with a parent, it becomes less scary. And the parent can always improvise. You don't have to read the words exactly as they are on the printed page. But then these stories go out into the world. We have now this resurgence of fairy tales in Hollywood culture. And the Little Red Riding Hood story, for example, has been adapted for adolescent audiences. We've got the action-adventure film, Hansel and Gretel. I think some of the more imaginative reinventions of fairy tales come in something like Django Unchained, which has the Sleeping Beauty story in it, embedded in it. But I remember watching the film and wondering, why is Hildy named Broomhilda?
Yeah.
And we quickly discover that, you know, she's been kept in this underground vault, and she is going to be rescued by Django. So this subtle use of the fairy tale, I think, is quite extraordinary and often makes for the most compelling cinema. It's always wonderful to discover these subtexts that lurk beneath the surface of the tales. And sometimes, do worry, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk, we should make that more interesting than the recent movie version.
Yeah.
I love every reinvention, and I love Snow White and the Huntsman. I think it's great to sort of see what happens to the story when it's taken up by someone new, when the terms are reimagined and all of that. But they're the wonderfully creative versions that do what every good fairy tale does, and that is to make us think more, to think hard about some of the issues that face us in our culture today.
Well, as you pointed out, there is no sacred original version of these stories. I mean, we have, as you call it in the book, imperfect fragments. We have these bits and pieces here and there, and they kind of morph over time. So I guess in some way, the way we tell a story is a reflection of us. It's quite personal, the spin we put on it, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think that there are ways in which the refashioning of the tales becomes symptomatic. That is, we begin to understand something about ourselves by seeing how we've reworked the tales. And then the great thing is that these stories get us talking. So it's not as if you just watch the movie and think, oh, you know, now this is happening in our culture at that. But rather, we take that tale and start to debate it. You know, how should it have ended? What went wrong here? How could it have sort of pointed us in a different direction. How would I rewrite it? How would I re-script it? How would I tell it to a child? If I were making a film, what would I do with this material?
So you've talked about how these are, you know, oral folk stories told mostly for adults early on. And the Grimm brothers, they transform them into, I guess in some ways they make them more literary stories, of course, not just an oral tradition. And also you point out that these weren't for kids at first. At least that was not their intent, to make these palatable for children.
That's right. And it was the genius of the Brothers Grimm, first of all, to create a compact version of the fairy tale. Mm. That is, when you look at their efforts, when they were first recording these stories, they tried to take them down literally. And you get these long, rambling sentences. There was a miller, and he had three sons, and he decided that he was going to sell the mill, let the boys go out into the world, and then, and then, and then.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're yawning at that point. But somehow they created this wonderfully kind of clip, a wonderful narrative pace, so that they became easy to read. They were short, sweet, and bitty. I think one of the reasons we love them today is that they just communicate information in a very rapid, compact form. So the Grimms were able to take this sort of lumbering form from the fireside, you know, where you had an entire evening. You could spice up the story depending on who was there. If the children were still awake and you didn't want to get too racy, you might save that for the later hours. But people needed to stay awake. They had chores to do, and as we know, it's always easier to take care of something, especially when you're doing repetitive labor. It's always easier when there's a song, a melody, a story to move you along. Imagine sitting at the spinning wheel all night. You need a story to keep you going.
Mm.
And you need more than, those child-friendly versions,
right.
I think, that the Grimms gave to
us.
Yeah. You need to have a Rapunzel who is pregnant, we discover that those visits from the prince lead directly to her pregnancy. In the Grimms version, she just happens to get pregnant after she leaves the tower.
You know,
it's never clear that it's the prince.
Yeah. Do you ever wonder, this is a strange way to put it, but was there ever a point when you figure, gosh, they kind of ruined these stories by sanitizing them so much?
I don't think it's possible to do that because the Grimms are just one data point on a very big map of, they're part of the great cauldron of storytelling. So my sense is, you know, people say to me, well, were you disappointed with this version or that version? And I sort of think that it's just one big stew, and nobody can spoil it because there's so much in it. And we keep adding to it. And so that, you know, the Grimms, what the Grimms did, and it was their mission, really, to keep these stories alive.
Yeah.
They knew that they were disappearing. They were part of an oral storytelling tradition, so write them down now. And they then modeled practices that were carried out in Russia, in Scandinavian countries, and then all over the world. Everyone was eager to have a collection, to put things down on paper so that the stories would still be alive.
Mm.
And now, you know, they've gone from the covers of books into, you know, cultural entertainments, electronic entertainments. So we have different delivery systems, as the media gurus say. But, you know, the story is just still there. It hasn't lost any of its power.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I guess there's this sense that these stories are supposed to just be these cautionary tales that teach a moral. But you see, even though the Grimms did try to make their stories, you know, a kind of a model of good behavior, you say they were aware that the values in the stories didn't always square with purity and innocence. It wasn't that simple, I guess.
Not at all. So that you get this wonderful story about the Frog King.
Yeah.
Where the girl is told by her father, when you make a promise, you must keep it. The Grimms added that because they wanted to create a kind of manual of manners. And here's the fact, but there's a certain absurdity to that, you know, that if you promise a frog that you will let him in the house, you have to keep that promise. But then later in the story, what does she do? And this seems to be perfectly all right. She throws the frog against the wall.
Right.
And lo and behold, that is the moment in which he's transformed into a prince.
Yeah.
So she's rewarded for this act of violence. She's not at all compassionate the way that beauty is. Beauty brings beasts back to life by kissing him, by bringing feelings of compassion into her relationship with him. So there's a funny way in which you get mixed messages all the time in fairy tales. And I always think it's hilarious when people try to twist and turn the tales into moral lessons. Charles Perrault in France added an explicit moral at the end of every tale.
Right.
And you read the moral and you start scratching your head and saying, wait a minute, no. I just read about a thief, a boy who lies and cheats his way to success. This can't possibly mean X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, I thought about that with Rumpelstiltskin because it's a story you point out in the book. It's an interesting story to include in a collection for children because, as you say, it sort of turns on deception and greed. You've got this miller who's tricking the king into thinking his daughter can spin straw into gold. And then, as you say, all the characters, they're rash, they're irresponsible, they're opportunistic. Talk about that story. That's really interesting.
Oh, it is. And as you said, all the characters seem to engage in deceptive behavior. And yet, why do we keep reading that story? And I would say two things. One, the beauty of being able to make something from nothing. And remember, these stories are being told in sewing circles, spinning rooms. Mm-hmm. And here you've got a character who's able to take straw and turn it into gold, which I think is exactly what the fairy tale does. You know, to take nothing, to take mere words and turn them into something really beautiful. But then there's also... And I think everyone who has heard this tale or read this tale has a different moment that he or she highlights. But I think there's also just the riddle of the name and these hilarious possibilities that are raised. So there's a kind of joy of playing with language in the story, and you know, trying to guess a name that is impossible, that, you know, somehow, you know, how could anyone figure out this name? And sort of seeing how the queen manages to save herself from this, you know, worst possible case scenario. What could be worse than the idea of losing your child? So there are just so many powerful moments in that story. And I think that's why, you know, parents reading the story to the child might overlook the deception because there are so many fascinating moments in the tale.
It's interesting where you say Rumpelstiltskin serves as less a sort of demonic helper. You say he's a kind of an agent of transformation.
Yes, for sure, because he's able to help the princess, help the miller's daughter become a princess. So he's, you know, in a way, he has this catalytic power, but remember also that not all versions of Rumpelstiltskin end with his tearing himself in two.
Yeah.
In some versions, he just, and I love this one, he just flies away on a spoon. He manages to get out of this situation. And there, you know, he might be seen as just a benign figure who a donor of sorts or a helper of sorts who enables the princess to get what she needs to live happily ever after.
Maria Tatar is with us. She's a scholar of Germanic language and literature, as well as folklore and mythology at Harvard University. She's also the editor of the book, The Annotated Brothers Grimm. You can join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. The stories you were told as a kid may have changed some over time. In another era, they featured murder and cannibalism, child abuse, and a surprising amount of sex. Our guest is the scholar Maria Tatar. She's telling us about the Brothers Grimm, the oral folk stories they collected and transformed, and how tales like these are always being reworked to say something about the values of their time and their place. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I want to come back to Little Red Riding Hood, if we can, because I think it's interesting to talk about the way this story, the different versions of this story. What I found really interesting about it is that a lot of us think of Little Red Riding Hood as someone who gets rescued by a hunter at the end. She's kind of hapless and passive. But there are a lot of versions where she takes the initiative. She's the trickster.
Yes, my favorite is the story of Grandmother, where the girl performs a little striptease in front of the wolf. It's not what big teeth you have or what big eyes you have. Instead, the wolf is enumerating each item of clothing that she takes off, you know, tells her to put it in the fire. And once she gets in bed with the wolf, it dawns on her that this is not her grandmother, but a wolf. And what does she do? She tells him that she has to go outside to relieve herself. He then responds, just do it in bed.
Right.
And she insists, she's quite insistent. She gets outside. He's put a rope around her leg, thinking that this will be a way to pull her back in. But she takes the rope off, and what does she do? She runs back home. So she does not need a huntsman to rescue her. She is the classic trickster figure. Mm-hmm. And she gets home on her own.
It's, you know, she is, there's also a version you've talked about where she eats, she drinks Granny's blood and eats Granny's flesh. That's another version.
Right, and there the wolf is a bit of a trickster. He kills Grandmother and then puts her flesh on this plate and her blood into a bottle. So he fools Little Red Riding Hood. And I think that it's so fascinating, isn't it? Because it takes us into a kind of intergenerational rivalry. That is, you know, the girl has to somehow incorporate her grandmother in this strange way. And, you know, these symbols flash out at us. It's the flesh and blood. It's the reworking of the Eucharist. So these stories just have so many deep layers.
There's a version that the Nazis, the spin that Nazis put on this story, making it this encounter between this, you know, trusting Aryan innocent girl and this predatory Jew. Talk about the anti-Semitism in these stories, because there's a strong sense of nationalism in Germany at the time of the Brothers Grimm, and this anti-Semitism comes up in the stories from time to time.
Oh, right. Well, it was easy enough for the Nazis to just turn this into grist for their ideological mills, because so many of these stories have predator-prey relationships. They work out that relationship. And there's always a villain and there's always an innocent in the stories. So they had no trouble rewriting the tales. More worrisome, I think, and this is something that does take us out of our comfort zones, is the fact that you come across a story in the Grimm's collection. And this was included even in the shorter version for children, the 50 Tales for Children, and is still available in versions for children today in Germany. And it's called The Jew in the Thorn Bush. Yeah. And what you have there is an honest German fellow, an apprentice, a servant who's been working for a master who cheats him out of fair wages. And this fellow goes out into the world and meets a Jew who is corrupt and venal, who becomes kind of a proxy for the master who cheated the young man out of his wages. And by the end of the tale, the honest young German fellow is fiddling and the poor Jew is dancing in the thorns. It is the Jew who perishes in the end, but who's actually been the honest one throughout the tale. Yeah. He's been deceived and given the runaround by the so-called honest fellow. Now, this is the story. It's often known as, or it's known by folklorists, as the tale of the three gifts. So there were many different types of villains that the Grimms could have put into the position occupied by the Jew. And, you know, why they put the Jew in that position when they could have found a cleric or something like that makes me worry. I mean, they were, they were liberal, enlightened in many ways, but obviously not in this way.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you could also argue that maybe what they were trying to do was capture the mentality of the time.
Right.
And they decided, you know, we're not going to fool around. We're not going to cheat and clean these up in that way. And in some ways, maybe, you know, we need to be grateful for the fact that they included the versions that we look at today and worry about and start to probe and investigate in order to get a window into the mentality of the time.
It's interesting. It didn't – I guess it, I'm sure the anti-Semitism bothered W.H. Auden, but he kind of looked past that in some ways. You say in the book that he described the tales as our common property and these books being in some ways the stories, a basis for Western culture. So I guess he was able to sort of look – not look the other way, but see them in their context, I suppose.
I think that's right. And he knew the power of Cinderella, of Little Red Riding Hood, Rumpelstiltskin, all those tales. And the Jew in the Thorn Bush is, although it's obviously not in the versions sold in many bookstores today or available online, but it's a tale that was included in British versions. Mm. 20th century British versions, and then illustrated by Arthur Rackham in ways that, you know, sort of deepen the anti-Semitism. You get a stereotypical Jew dancing in the brambles.
Yeah.
So this is, tells us the story is a rich source, I think, of cultural information.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's take a call. Donald is with us in Salt Lake. Donald, welcome.
Hello. Hi. Nice to be on your program. I enjoy it every day.
Good.
My comment has to do with how disappointed I was in the recent Disney tale of Rapunzel. What made me disappointed was not the fact that she's a relatively much less of a damsel in distress, but it actually went the wrong direction in terms of the relationship. Where she ends up with a scoundrel, and as a therapist, I think that's what I deal with in my practice is people actually believing things like you can reform a man with your love. They don't believe you can spin straw into gold, but they believe the relationship elements, which are just as much magical and fantasy and not based in reality.
Maria Tatar, what do you think?
That's a great point. And if you look at Beauty and the Beast, it becomes even more worrisome because Beast is quite ferocious and out of control. He's got a real anger management problem in the Disney film. And yet, you know, there's this fantasy, oh, I can reform him. I can tame him. He will become marriage material. I hadn't thought of that in the context of Tangled, but you make a very good point because he does start out as a kind of, more than shady, a thief and everything else. So this notion of being able to reform and get to the true, pure heart, in a way, through the fairy tale is deeply problematic. But again, I think... you know, thank goodness we don't just simply accept the story as sacred.
Yeah.
That is, you watched it and you're able to talk about it and see the shortcomings and think about how you would re-script it.
I know you don't make a particular value judgment about how Disney has the Disney spin on some of these stories. But you, let's take Snow White, for example. You mentioned the Walt Disney version really has come to kind of overshadow the other versions. Do you think in some ways that's a shame or that's just the way it is?
Oh, I worry about the fact that when I Google Snow White, the first 5,000 images come from the Disney version.
Yeah, yeah.
If I want to see different illustrations for the story, I have to get through several pages. And so there is this dominant version. And in fact, many of my students, they come to class and they think that Disney made these stories up because, you know, that is the version that we all encounter. And we encounter it again and again, not just in the cartoon version, but in, you know, we see that image again and again.
Yeah.
So I think the great thing is, you know, we should be irreverent. We should be irreverent about the Grimms. We shouldn't say, oh, Disney, you know, that's problematic.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the Grimms.
Yeah.
Not at all. Let's use those as platforms, as springboards for thinking about the tale in new ways. And I don't think we have to always be politically correct. I think someone may make a version that is not our cup of tea, but, you know, we don't have to accept it. We can create a counter-argument, a counter-narrative, and take the tale in a completely different direction. These tales were never meant to be set in stone.
Yeah. The Snow White story, the way you've written about it, I think is interesting because you write about what you call the Oedipal entanglements and the different versions of that story. Maybe say something about that, if you would.
Oh, it's fascinating to me that it is our story about mother-daughter rivalry and that compelling queen in the Disney version. She's so much more interesting than Snow White. Remember that extraordinary underground cavern that she enters with dusty books and ravens and skulls and all kinds of potions and and there's sweet little Snow White who, you know, I mean, she, of course, is the fairest of them all, and she lives happily ever after. But the whole dynamic turns on the relationship between the two of them. And I love the fact that Snow White and the Huntsman took that up and deepened that generational rivalry and connected it with a cougar culture and our own, you know, fantasies about wanting to remain forever young. So that seemed to me, even if you didn't like every aspect of the film, it seemed to me a very successful re-engagement with the core of the story.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Donald, thanks very much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Paul is with us in Lehigh. Paul, welcome.
You were just talking about Freudian themes, and I'm thinking about the writings of a Swiss-German psychotherapist who turned away from psychoanalysis, Freudian style, and has written several books about the social and individual consequences of child abuse, either physical or emotional, telling children that they're only loved if they are obedient and cooperative, and the damage that does. And I, as I think about the Grimm tales, I think they're replete and ongoing images of, if nothing else, that children were treated and badly and not given their chance of freedom. Alice Miller also talks about how the gross, almost universal practice of abusing and marginalizing children made a people who were willing to follow an Adolf Hitler.
Maria,
I'd be interested in your comments.
Yeah, what do you think?
Take off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, it's a great point because look at these stories. Hansel and Gretel, abandoned in the woods.
Yeah.
And remember how they're abandoned. That is, they're taken into the woods, and then the father puts his axe up in the tree to mimic the sound of his chopping wood, and then he runs off. So it's a frightening story, and we find that situation again and again in fairy tales where children are left on their own and are not nurtured and protected by adults. What's important to me is that I think that every child has moments, no matter how happy your childhood may have been. There are times when you felt like the innocent, persecuted hero or heroine of your own life, that nobody was helping you and you're vulnerable. You're at the mercy of these giants. You have to deal with them. And fairy tales are just so reassuring in that way, because suddenly here's a story that tells you no matter how bad it is, no matter how desperate the situation, there are people out in the world that are going to come to your assistance. You don't have to go alone. And you will use your wits and your courage to find a way out. Now, it's true that we know in real life not everyone lives happily ever after, but hope is a very powerful agent. And I think every child, whether they have been actually physically abused or sexually abused or simply made to feel small, meek, powerless, needs a story like that, needs to keep hope alive.
I was also interested in what you wrote about Hansel and Gretel in terms of the children don't end up doing exactly the right thing. They eavesdrop on their parents. They're greedy about eating the witch's house. They run off with the witch's jewels. They're really just living on their wits, and they're not just cardboard cutouts, really.
No, not at all. And what I love about the story is the fact that they're able to use their sibling solidarity. And this isn't a story about sibling rivalry, but solidarity. Mm. And when Hansel is put into that cage and is powerless and can no longer find a strategy to get out, it's Gretel who takes charge. And Gretel, who has been, behind Hansel the whole time, sort of slightly behind, as the illustrators always show her, and she gets behind the witch, pushes her into the oven. And not only, it's not just the physical act, but she's clever. She says to the witch, "I don't know how to get in there. Can you show me how?" She asks her how to model entering the oven. So it's a deeply complicated story on many levels, and they aren't just, it's funny, the Grimms added this little scene where they say their prayers in the woods. Mm-hmm. And, the prayers, of course, aren't helpful at all. They have to use their own resources.
Maria Tatar is with us, professor of Germanic languages and literature, as well as folklore and mythology at Harvard. She is the editor of the Annotated Brothers Grimm, which was re-released last year. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. We have with us Maria Tatar, professor of Germanic languages and literature at Harvard. She is also the She's authored and edited a lot of books, including the annotated Brothers Grimm, which was re-released last year to commemorate the bicentennial of that first edition of the Brothers Grimm collection of fairy tales. She's joining us from Harvard University in Cambridge. So you keep hearing the stepmother keeps appearing in these stories time and time again, in Snow White and in Cinderella and all of these stories. What's the Brothers Grimm contribution to that? Because I think you've written about the fact that in a lot of these stories, it was just a bad biological mother. But I guess they're trying to sort of clean that image up a little bit, and that's where we get the wicked stepmother.
That's right, that somehow they wanted to preserve the sanctity of the biological mother. At the same time, it's so fascinating to me that they were recording these stories at a time when there were many stepmothers, when children had to deal with a stepmother who might have favored her biological child over the child that she's sort of been forced to adopt. So there's a wonderful compactness there in the use of the stepmother. And what's remarkable to me is the demonization of mothers in the Grimm's collections. Yeah. That is, you find in the story of Hansel and Gretel, which we were just talking about, it's the stepmother who takes the lead, who wants to abandon the children, who says, you know, we'll starve if we don't send them out into the woods. And the father, you know, weakly protests. He also, you know, uses that strategy of hanging the axe on the tree. But he is never seen in the same terms as the stepmother. Mm. So there are, though, many stories, actually, not only in the Grimm's collection, but in collections the world over, where you do get a father who sends his sons out into the world and simply says, you know, I can't give you anything. I've lost my fortune. So go see what you can do. And by the way, if you manage to make a living and earn some money, bring it back home. They don't, of course, and we also have these giants in fairy tales. You know, Jack and the Beanstalk. Jack lives at home with his mother. There's the absent father. And he reappears in this frightening form of the giant.
I wanted to ask you about the fisherman and his wife, which is an interesting story because, you know, just as you think that the Brothers Grimm stories are following some kind of formula, they go off the formula. I mean, this particular story doesn't follow that rags-to-riches pattern that you get in some fairy tales. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's not rags-to-riches.
No, not at all. And riches to rags. But yeah, there is something, a certain continuity there, because this is a story about the monstrosity of female power. And that's something that we get in the tales again and again, the Wicked Queen in Snow White. And here we have a woman who is supremely ambitious and just can never settle for enough, and finally, you know, wants to be not just pope or king but God. Yeah. And what happens in the end? She's left with nothing because she is greedy and glutton. I mean, there is a kind of this is one of the few tales, actually, I think, where you could read a very clear moral into the story. Mm-hmm. That is, don't ask for too much, especially if you're a woman.
Right. And be content. Be content.
Yes. Be content with that hovel that you have.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is one of those problems. I mean, a lot of feminist writers have problems with a lot of the themes in some of the Brothers Grimm stories and some of these old fairy tales, I guess.
Oh, yes. And we do have these great collections by Angela Carter and others, The Maid of the North. We have rewrites of the fairy tales. Angela Carter collected stories with strong heroines in them. And there are many out there, you know. So I think the great thing about what's happening today is that we've recognized, you know, there is no one standard version. There is no original. We can look for all of these different versions, compare them to each other, and figure out, you know, what is the story or what are the different versions of the story that we want to adopt or adapt today.
Mm. Let me ask you, we don't have a lot of time left, but I think there's time to talk about the juniper tree. I'm not sure if a lot of people are familiar. Maybe say a little bit about this story. This one was interesting for me, too.
Well, we're back with the stepmother, who in this case decapitates a little boy, her stepson. And not only that, she then blames it on her daughter and then wants to destroy the evidence by chopping the boy up and putting him into a stew for the father. And this is a story about transformation and change. And the boy turns into a beautiful bird. He's sort of like the phoenix. Mm. And what does he do? He brings back song, these wonderful aromas. Everywhere he goes and sings, everyone wants to hear his song. They smell the cinnamon that surrounds him. And he's a figure of visual beauty as well. There he has rhinestones in his eyes and multicolored and all of that. And so you could read it as a story of redemption. Mm-hmm. He manages to come back. And then the violence, he drops, what does this beautiful bird do but drop a millstone? A biblical punishment is visited on the stepmother. So this takes us, I think, into the mythical, and it reminds me of how fairy tales are not just these little stories for children, domestic tales about the family, but they are big. They take on all of the fundamental questions that we find in myths and in legends and in biblical narratives.
Yeah. Less than a minute left. Let me ask you this: it sounds like you talked about how there's, you know, there will be different delivery systems, but it sounds to me like you think that that we'll still find these stories, we'll still tell these tales even in the future.
Oh, absolutely! They circulate. They're part of they're in our cultural bloodstream. They are not about to go away. And the great thing about them, as Einstein put it, you know, if you want intelligent children, tell them fairy tales. If you want more intelligent children, tell them more fairy tales. Because these are stories that are just good to think with. They make us think more. They make us think harder about family life, about what it means to be human, how we are going to navigate the world in the midst of the beauty and the horror that surround us at every turn.
Maria Tatar, she's the editor of the Annotated Brothers Grimm, which was re-released last year. She joined us from a studio on the campus of Harvard University in Cambridge. Maria Tatar, thank you very much for the time.
Great to talk.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.